Defense of the United States unveils a fresh arms package for Ukraine consisting of precision rocket systems and combat drones. The Iraqi Resistance Force commemorates the anniversary of its establishment with a massive parade showing off its military might. Plus, Iran censures the Israeli regime's latest attack on Damascus suburbs for violating Syria's sovereignty. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shah Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The United States keeps pumping military aid into Ukraine. It has signed off an additional $270 million worth of weapons for the country to help it fight with Russia. The White House says President Joe Biden has made it clear that Washington will continue to support Ukraine and its people for as long as it takes. More than half of the latest aids come from a $40 billion package Congress approved for Ukraine in May. The aid includes portable drones and four more HIMARS precision rocket systems, among others. That brings to 20 the number of HIMARS systems sent to Ukraine. Officials there have called them a game changer in countering Russia. Moscow has already warned against sending arms to Ukraine, accusing the West of fueling the flames of war. And ever since the war in Ukraine started, we at Press TV have been closely following the developments there and keeping you updated. Central to that effort has been our correspondent on the ground, Johnny Miller, reporting from a war-torn country. It was already going to present its own challenges and risks, but now Johnny says that he has been placed on a kill list of the ultra-nationalist groups in Ukraine. This after he reported on a story about a kill list associated with the Ukrainian government promoting violence against pro-Russian children in the Donbass region. A number of journalists have been killed in Ukraine after being put on this list.
The notorious Ukrainian website Mirot Verets, meaning peacemaker, it publishes the names and addresses of those it deems to be enemies of Ukraine. The opening page shows pictures of dead Russian soldiers. On the list are domestic and foreign journalists, politicians, and citizens that in some way they view to have aided or worked with pro-Russian forces in the country. Now, shamefully, they are adding children to the list. Faina Sevenkova, she is 13 years old and has been writing about her experiences here in Donbass. After her name appeared on the list, she started to receive threats of physical violence online.
Are you worried about being on the website? Are you concerned that something might happen to you?
Yes, of course. A person I knew got to know my address and came to greet me for my birthday. These are good intentions, but something worse can happen. Websites like this shouldn't exist. They're illegal. They put many people in danger, children as well. I have a friend who was put on there because she wrote a poem about war.
Numerous journalists and public figures have been murdered after being put on the list, like Oles Bazina, who was shot near his home in Kiev, and Andrea Riccelli, an Italian journalist, after he was killed on the front line, the website posted liquidated over his photo. The Committee to Protect Journalists has previously written to the Ukrainian government asking them to condemn the unfounded and damaging allegations published on Mirotavets and to clarify publicly that the Ukrainian Interior Ministry is dedicated to protecting journalists. The United Nations and Human Rights Watch have also condemned the site. Dianis Bitkonen, a Finnish journalist in Donbass, he's also on the list.
It's all against all international laws, and you shouldn't have right, any country shouldn't have a right to do that kind of like hunting list, kill lists of people and put it to the public, especially. It's a very brutal way how to cause people serious problems, and many have lost their lives because of being on that list.
The website clearly states it provides information for law enforcement authorities and special services. Ukrainian government ministers have praised the site and it is actively used by the authorities to track and detain enemies of the state.
While Western media and governments try to whitewash the extremist or far-right neo-Nazi elements here in Ukraine, calling it Russian propaganda, for a website promoted, supported, and used by the government that openly encourages violence towards children is a clear indication that Ukraine does have a serious problem with state-sponsored extremism. They're basically encouraging people to kill people on the list?
Yeah. That's why I've been in since 2015. I certainly cannot fall to Ukrainian hands because I am on that list with several pages even. But like the old saying is that the others once terrorist is another one's freedom fighter, and hopefully all sense and truth and peace-loving people understand that all these people in that list are heroes.
To openly encourage violence towards children takes a special kind of evil, an evil that NATO countries, as they continue to pump Ukraine with money, weapons and political support, seem unwilling or incapable to challenge. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, Iraq's resistance force, the Popular Mobilization Units, has staged a military parade to commemorate the 8th anniversary of its formation. The parade was held at a military base in Diyala province, northern Iraq. Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi also attended the ceremony. He is also the commander-in-chief for the Iraqi Armed Forces, and he was attending where the PMU commanders, as well as a host of military and state officials, were also present. The march featured a parade by infantry units, tanks, and other military vehicles. Iraq's political party, Asaib Ahli al-Haq, has called on parliament to take measures in response to a Wednesday deadly attack on a northern village that was blamed on Turkey. The group, which is also part of Iraq's mobilization forces, said that the legislature should ask the UN Security Council to force Turkey to withdraw from Iraqi soil. It said that Turkey should also be obliged to pay compensation for killing Iraqis. Asaib Ahli al-Haq says that it will go into action to counter Turkish aggression if legislators fail to take the necessary actions. The group said that relentless acts of aggression, the establishment of military bases in Iraq, and violation of its sovereignty are far from the principles of good neighborliness. 9 people were killed in the shelling of Kurdish village that the Iraqi government blames on Turkey. Ankara has denied any involvement, saying that the attack was committed by terrorist organizations. To discuss that further, we're joined by Navid Behrouz, our Baghdad bureau chief. Joining us also is Mohammed Obaid, a political analyst who's joining us live from Beirut. Let's begin with our bureau chief in Baghdad, Mr. Behrouz. Thank you for joining us. Now, the role of Hashd al-Shaabi and the resistance forces in safeguarding Iraqi sovereignty, could you please elaborate on that?
Hello and welcome and greetings to you all. Well, in reaction to the Turkish attack on Iraq's Kurdistan, in which several civilians, actually 9 civilians, including women and children, were killed and 33 people were wounded, very angry reactions came in from Iraqi officials as well as from Iraqi people in protest at this attack. And today, the Iraqi parliament is going to meet in response to these attacks. Numerous requests have been made by Iraqi politicians and MPs, and in this meeting, serious decisions will be made in order to react to these attacks at different diplomatic, economic, and parliamentary levels. And also, a lawsuit is going to be filed with the UN against this attack if Turkey does not. If Turkey does not actually leave its bases in Iraq, in that case, the popular mobilization units, the PMU, will give a military response to Turkey's attacks. On the other hand, today we saw the PMU stage a very important parade in Iraq, in which featured different types of light and heavy weapons. In this parade, the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi was present. Also, the PMU commander, Mr. Fayyad, and Hadi al-Amali, the head of the Badr organization, as well as a host of high-ranking Iraqi officials and some ambassadors of foreign countries were also present at the parade. From a military point of view, this parade is very important, and the PMU showed off its military might. Drones were displayed, as well as modern tanks, including T-72 and T-52, plus some other types of missiles and heavy weaponry and radar systems. Anti-intelligence radar systems. This shows that the PMU is increasing its military might day by day. More importantly, in addition to PMU units, forces from other Iraqi intelligence, security sources, as well as other military organizations were present. This shows that all armed forces of Iraq are united in defending the country. And more importantly, was the presence of Mustafa al-Kadhimi at the parade, which shows the importance of the PMU, and it is a response to all the accusations leveled against the PMU, because some say that PMU is acting outside the authority of official Iraqi organizations, but this shows that the PMU is working alongside other Iraqi armed forces and intelligence forces and security forces, and is protecting Iraq. Given the challenges facing Iraq today, especially security challenges in Kurdistan following the Turkish attacks on Iraq, and some believe that these attacks are a result of the silence of the Iraqi government, as well as the silence of Kurdistan officials, especially the Democratic Party of Kurdistan, headed by Mr. Barzani, because of the interests that he and other Kurdistan officials have, their interests with Turkey. We are at a sensitive juncture now. The Iraqi parliament is going to hold an important meeting today, and this meeting will delineate the future of Iraq's relations. Actually, we'll discuss the future of Iraq's relations with Turkey. If Turkey continues its attacks on Iraq, in the first stage, a diplomatic response will be on the agenda and filing a lawsuit with the UN. And if Turkey continues its attacks further, there will be a military response to Turkey, especially through popular forces and resistance forces. We saw over the past 2 days that there were reactions and responses by popular resistance fronts, and actually they included missile attacks and Grad missiles, as well as drones. Actually, we saw that attacks by drones, and this shows that Iraq, when it comes to its sovereignty, Iraq is very serious and will not remain silent in that regard.
Okay, Mr. Obeid, we're running out of time. Turkey argues that it is concerned about the PKK forces. Do you believe that military deployment would be the answer to this concern?
Of course not, and of course one should not take this as a pretext, because we have a similar situation which is being dealt in Syria also. Turkey using the pretext of security concerns in order to invade and create some regional borderlines for the areas as the same is being applied in Turkey. In a nutshell, it is the creation of this chaotic situation in countries, basically by some by the Americans, by their allies in the region, and then for Turkey to come and harvest the outcome of this in order to fulfill its ambitions in regional territories, and whether in Syria or in Iraq. So, of course, there is an unnatural situation when it comes to the Kurdish issue, with which needs to be dealt politically by the Turkey officials in this regard in the first place. Then there won't be such a problem in all these areas. So, once again, it is Turkey using and exploiting the unstable situations in its neighboring countries in order to fulfill its ambitions, which are clear to everybody, whether in Aleppo, whether in northern Iraq, in the oil areas in these countries. So it is not, it's only a pretext which is being used in order to serve these goals.
Okay, that was Mr. Mohammed Obaid, political analyst, joining us live from Beirut, and our Baghdad bureau chief, Navid Behrouz. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review. Moving on, Syria has called on the United Nations to condemn Israel's attacks on Damascus suburbs on Friday that killed 3 soldiers and injured 7 others. In separate letters to the UN Secretary General and the UN Security Council, the Syrian Foreign Ministry said Damascus reserves the right to respond to Israel's repeated acts of aggression. The ministry added that the UN should take action to prevent Israel's attacks. Iran also strongly denounced the Israeli raids as atrocious and a clear violation of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Tehran also criticized the silence of international bodies, especially the Security Council, in the face of what it called Israel's persisting crimes and dangerous behavior. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. In the U.S., prosecutors in Atlanta have informed 16 Donald Trump supporters who formed an alternate slate of 2020 presidential electors from Georgia that they could face charges in an ongoing criminal investigation into election interference, underscoring the risk of criminal charges that Donald J. Trump and many of his allies may be facing in the state. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalist Danny Hakim. The piece is titled Trump Electors Targeted in Georgia Criminal Inquiry. In the U.S., prosecutors in Atlanta have informed 16 Donald Trump supporters who formed an alternate state of 2020 presidential electors from Georgia that they could face charges in an ongoing criminal investigation into election interference, underscoring the risk of criminal charges that Donald J. Trump and many of his allies may be facing in the state. The revelations were included in court filings released on Tuesday, 19th of July, in an investigation being led by Fannie T. Willis, the district attorney of Fulton County, Georgia. They showed that while much attention has been focused on the House hearings in Washington into the January 6th attack on the Capitol and the extent to which the Justice Department will investigate, it is a local prosecutor in Atlanta who may put Donald Trump and his circle of allies in the most immediate legal peril. This is a sign of a dramatic acceleration of her work, said Norman Eisen, who served as special counsel to the House Judiciary Committee during the first Trump impeachment. He added that prosecutors typically work their way up the food chain, so usually the first wave of target letters is not the last. A special grand jury is looking into a range of potential issues, including the creation of a slate of 16 pro-Trump electors in the weeks after the election in an attempt to circumvent President Joe Biden's victory in the state. The district attorney is seeking testimony from a number of Donald Trump's lawyers and allies, including Rudolph Giuliani, who has emerged as a central figure in the case, and also Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, whose lawyers agreed on Tuesday, 19th of July, to have their objections heard in a court in Georgia instead of South Carolina or Washington. Some legal observers have argued that Donald Trump's actions put him at risk of being indicted on charges of violating relatively straightforward Georgia criminal statutes, including criminal solicitation to commit election fraud. Most notably, his post-election phone calls to Georgia officials like Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State in Georgia, whom he pressured to find 11,780 votes, enough to reverse the election results. A 114-page Brookings Institution analysis of the case, co-authored by Norman Eisen, found Donald Trump at substantial risk of possible state charges predicated on multiple crimes. Fannie Willis, in court filings, has indicated that a number of other charges are being considered, including racketeering and conspiracy, which could take in a broad roster of Trump associates both inside and outside of Georgia. Ms. Willis is also weighing whether to subpoena Donald Trump himself and seek his testimony, according to a person familiar with the inquiry, as she has recently sought the testimony of seven of his allies and advisers before the special grand jury. Lawyers for 11 of the electors reacted strongly to the designation of their clients as targets, saying that a local prosecutor had no jurisdiction to determine which federal electors were fake and which were real. The lawyers, Holly Pearson and Kimberly Burrows Debro, accused Fannie Willis of misusing the grand jury process to harass, embarrass, and attempt to intimidate the nominee electors, not to investigate their conduct. Fannie Willis's office did not immediately comment, but she has said that anything that is relevant to attempts to interfere with the Georgia election will be subject to review. President Joe Biden won Georgia and all 16 of its electoral votes, but after the election, Some of Donald Trump's outside advisors came up with a plan to create slates of alternate electors in swing states like Georgia, falsely claiming that widespread fraud had disrupted the election in those states. Many of Donald Trump's White House advisors rejected the plan, and efforts to get Vice President Mike Pence to block the certification of electoral votes on 6th of January 2021, and viewed it as dangerous and illegal, testimony in the House hearings have shown. Two of the Georgia electors had already been identified as targets of Fannie Willis's investigation. David Schaefer, a Trump ally who chairs the state Republican Party, and Burt Jones, a Georgia state lawmaker who is running for lieutenant governor. The lawyers for 11 of the electors, including David Schaefer, accused Fannie Willis of politicizing the investigation and said that many of the nominee electors are prominent figures in the Georgia GOP. The electors include Mark Amick, who serves on the board of the Georgia Republican Foundation, a group of the party's large donors, Vicky Consiglio, the party's assistant treasurer, Sean Steele, who won a primary for a state Senate seat earlier this year, Brad Carver, an Atlanta lawyer, and Kay Godwin, the co-founder of a group called Georgia Conservatives in Action. Most of the electors were supposed to testify before the special grand jury next week, but in late June, Holly Pearson and Kimberly Burroughs Debro wrote in their filings that they were told by a special prosecutor that their 11 clients were considered targets, not just witnesses, in the investigation after new evidence had come to light. There is no legal or factual basis to label the nominee electors as targets of this or any grand jury, the lawyer said. Nonetheless, the district attorney has rashly elevated them from witnesses to targets, and the nominee electors have informed her of their intention to follow our legal counsel to invoke their state and federal constitutional and statutory rights, not to provide substantive testimony. It's bizarre, said Clark D. Cunningham, a law professor at Georgia State University in Atlanta, Georgia. Clark Cunningham added, "They're arguing their case now, even though none of their clients have been indicted. The purpose of this motion appears to be to ask a judge to decide in advance of a grand jury decision that a grand jury can't even indict them." But the lawyers asserted that states and their local governments have no authority to interfere through attempted criminalization or otherwise with a process of sending potential electoral slates to Congress for it to adjudicate. They also pointed to the 1960 presidential election in Hawaii, where both the Nixon and Kennedy campaigns submitted electors in asserting that there was precedent for more than one slate of electors. Burt Jones, in a motion earlier this week, called for Fannie Willis to recuse herself because she has headlined fundraisers for Charlie Bailey, a Democrat who is running against Burt Jones. Ms. Willis rejected that idea in a court filing on Tuesday, 19th of July, the subject of the grand jury investigation that has ensnared Burt Jones has no factual connection to the ongoing campaign for lieutenant governor, she wrote, adding that support for a political opponent is not among the extremely rare instances where a prosecutor is shown to have a personal interest in a prosecution. The court filing also said that Burt Jones had been treated identically to each of the 15 other unofficial electors who represented themselves as properly certified electors for the 2020 presidential election and who received similar target status notification. The potential legal exposure of the Republican officials could complicate Georgia's November elections, starting with the lieutenant governor's race. Last week, Mr. Bailey accused Burt Jones of being anti-American and unpatriotic for taking part in a failed attempt at overthrow of the American government. The investigation has also highlighted divisions within Republican ranks. David Schaefer has been a stalwart supporter of Donald Trump and his baseless claims of a stolen election, which have put him at odds with Governor Brian Kemp, a Republican, as well as Brad Raffensperger. Both Brian Kemp and Brad Raffensperger easily defeated Trump-backed primary challengers this year. Representative Jody Heiss, who lost in a May primary to Brad Raffensperger, revealed this week that he had been subpoenaed in the investigation. A loyal Donald Trump ally, he led a January 2021 challenge in the House of Representatives to the certification of Georgia's electors. He is seeking to challenge the subpoena in federal court. The biggest question looming over the investigation, of course, is the potential exposure of Donald Trump himself. She has made clear that she has a sharp eye on Donald Trump, Norman Eisen said of Fannie Willis, adding that there were indications that this first salvo of target letters would be followed by additional possible targets, culminating in the former president himself.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Chile's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has tendered his resignation, which will pave the way for snap elections. It is reported that fractious parties torpedoed his national unity government, and that could bring the hard right to power. Why wouldn't the coalition parties, for the sake of the country, try to smooth things out and solve their problems, especially during a time when Italy, like many European countries, is experiencing economic challenges? This edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what kind of future will be waiting for Italy. Our guests for this edition of The Spotlight are the Secretary General of the CIPI Foundation, Paolo Raffone, joins us from Brussels. Also joining us is President of the European Institute for International Law and International Relations, Mahmoud Rafat, who joins us from Stockholm.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I will first start with you, if I may, Paolo Raffone. And we're looking, obviously, at a political crisis there in Italy. And the way that the crisis was sparked, based on the reports that we got, was some disagreements that were on the economic approach, let's say, by Mario Draghi, which the Five Star was said to have snubbed a key vote last week on that. How do you see things at this point in the way that they have unfolded?
Well, it's clear the government headed by Draghi is over and elections will come. Elections which have been awaited for quite a time, and the situation in the country was stable, but there were no improvements in terms of living standards under the Draghi's government. So the crisis that has been sparked also by the war in Ukraine, the increase in the prices, the inflation, have complicated a lot the conditions of many sectors of the Italian society. And certain parties have been demanding a change in the approach to Draghi, who didn't want to do it. So he ignored basically the requests, and this has then precipitated into a non-vote, which was not a non-confidence vote, but was a non-vote of one of the members of the coalition supporting the government. Then after this, the reaction by Draghi has been yet more stiffy, and this has caused other parties to join the non-vote procedure. Therefore, there was no more political majority for him.
Well, Mahmoud Rafat, what do you think about these three parties that were in coalition, basically looking at the Salvini's Anti-Immigrant League, the Populist Five-Star Movement, and then you have, obviously, the center-right Forza Italia? Does the combination of them, along with Draghi, too overwhelming for example, reforms to take place and leading to what we're looking at right now?
Well, the withdrawal was somehow expected of these three political parties. But let me tell you, the most critical part of these three parties is the five-star movement, because as we know, it's a populist movement, and the populism somehow is invading Europe on several levels now, backed by the immigration topic, also the economic crisis, and recently the situation with Russia, which is also impacting the European economy heavily. And as we have been seeing last few weeks, the euro went down for the first time in front of the US dollar to be less than one US dollar. This is not only the immigration, not only the economic situation, this is a result of the group, of the bunch of elements which made a big and high pressure on the European economy. And when there is serious economic problems, always populist movements can increase and can rise and can find acceptance on the ground. And this is the most critical thing we will face, not only in Italy, because we must also understand both Italy and France are somehow a guide of Europe politically. The eyes of rest of Europe watch these two Latin countries very carefully, and the populations of northern people, southern people of Europe get impacted by the movement of and the political movement in these two Latin countries, because they are ancient countries and they have very big soft power on the rest of Europe. So the most, again, I would repeat that the most critical withdrawal and the most critical issue we are facing today is the Five Stars movement behavior, as it is will impact other European countries. Italy in particular, has lots of political problems since few years, especially because of the economic situation and also somehow the problem of the immigration. But still, again, if the movement, the five-star movement, doesn't take a rational way, that will make these problems heavier and stronger.
Well, Paul Arafona, if you think about it, you couldn't have a better person in that position with the resume that Mario Draghi has. I mean, honestly, when you take a look at it, the governor of the Bank of Italy, the chairman of the Financial Stability Forum, and of course, you know, he was heading the worst, probably one of the worst financial crises, the financial crisis of 2008, that he was involved in. So why did things not go as smoothly as his resume dictates, in a sense?
From a technical point of view, he is a very respectable person, as we all know. And in technical terms, he has been leading the government correctly. The problem is that he's not a politician. He doesn't have a political feeling. He doesn't have a social feeling. He's a technician. And life is not only made of technical issues. It's made also of sentiments. And his attitude has not facilitated at all the swallowing by the political parties of his policies. And he has demonstrated his limits in handling a political and social situation, which for at least the past 2 months has been signaling that something was not going in the desired direction.
Well, if you take a look at the way that the supporters are expressing themselves, Mahmoud Rafat, obviously they're not too happy about this, obviously. But they're saying, and this warning is my question to you, that they're viewing this as a government collapse. And they're saying and warning that this is going to worsen the social ills when you have such bad economic indicators, for example, like inflation or a delay in the budget. Of course, you're also looking at the way that the Ukraine conflict has affected not just Italy, but many European economies. So why couldn't these parties set aside the differences, as Draghi said, and work things out?
Sorry, would you repeat the question again? The line.
Why couldn't they set aside their differences at this very, very sensitive time and work things out instead of having Italy be dragged out or dragged down with the economic challenges that the country is facing?
Well, I think, let me agree with my colleague Paolo here. Mr. Draghi is a very excellent person as economist. Mr. Draghi is a very theocratic person and professional in his domain as economist. He used to be president of the Central Bank of Europe, and he is very successful, but he is not a politician. Political world is completely different than the economic life and the economic world. The also meantime, he has very tendency to the socialism and the social approach for the society, which is not really to enable a politician to succeed, to handle and to manage a government under him, and number of ministers coming from different backgrounds and number of political parties, and each political party has its own interest. So the issue is in the non-political experience of Mr. Draghi himself. This is the main point. Yes, he has very excellent and very high profile as economist, but not as politician. And this is the point here. Let's say Italy is not easy country. It has a long history with elections, with democratic games, with political games. It has a very, very, very long history. It's a Latin country. So it's not that easy to manage this number of political parties if you do not have enough experience and if you are not well-trained to do that. Mr. Draghi was not well-trained to do that. He was wonderful in his position in the European Central Bank. He was wonderful as economist, but as politician, he could not really manage and handle the whole elements of Italy.
Okay. Well, let's see here. If we want to take a look at how somebody who should be acquainted with politics to have that facet be on his resume, which obviously the post of a prime minister should do that or should have that. The alternative here is, hold on, let me make sure I get this party straight. the Brothers of Italy Party. Is that what we're looking at here? Paolo Raffone, neo-fascist roots, leading in the polls with 23.9%. If I had a choice between the Brothers of Italy Party and Mario Draghi, hands down, I think people would go for Mario Draghi. But tell us what you think, if this is who's the party that's leading in the polls.
Well, first of all, to label it neo-fascist is completely wrong, because it is a party of right, for sure, conservative, but the transformation from its long past happened about 35 or 40 years ago, and it has nothing to do anymore with the roots of the fascism. So this is something to be understood. It is a right-wing conservative party, that's for sure. The population in Italy is scared, but it's scared by everything. It's scared by the situation, and therefore they look for some security somewhere. And I would say that easily you will have a split at almost 50% of people who would think that a more determined, conservative, right-wing ruling gives them this opportunity, as well as another 50% would prefer the status quo, and if a Draghi program without Draghi will be presented, they will vote for that. And this is the gamble that is in this election now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then I stand corrected in terms of what you described very well for us, the roots being there, but that was before, and now obviously they don't have that description, fit that description of neo-fascist. Now, what are we looking at, Mahmoud Rafat, when we're taking a look at what the country's going to be headed down to in terms of the snap election? Are we looking at a period of uncertainty, which really there's no time to waste given the economic landscape of Europe? And, of course, Italy is not obviously immune to what's this really nightmare scenario, economically speaking?
Well, which I expect Italy will suffer and will seriously suffer economically next few months. Especially the European Union now will not be able to present more aid packages under the financial situation and the economic situation of the European Union itself now. Let's remember that the main aid, or the biggest part of aid for the European Union, comes from the biggest two economies in Europe, which are Germany and France. And both of them are, Germany and France, I mean, have a serious problem with the gas for the moment, especially the winter is not very far from us. The winter will start in Europe within 2 months and a half, 3 months maximum. We will start, especially in the north of Europe, to suffer of the lacking of the gas. There will be gas lacking and shortage on the gas because of the Russian-Ukrainian war. And that will impact a lot the European economies, especially the French and the German. And so I expect the real problem will come in Italy, that the European Union will not give its back to Italy, because it never made, and the European Union was always there to help any European state which has such problem. But this time, the European Union will not be able, in my estimation, to help as should be. That's why there will be big inflation, there will be unemployment will increase, there will be lots of economic problems in the country, and these problems, how deep they will go, it will depend on the depth, I mean, of the economic problems, will depend on the coalitions to get back again and to bring stability back to the country again. If, because today there were some people talking about new elections in September, if that happens, sure, the economic problems will be much less than if the elections held in February or March 2023.
Well, in terms of the EU, since you're talking about that, Paolo Raffone, from what I'm understanding, the Brothers of Italy has repeatedly blamed the EU for Italy's troubles. Why do you think they're saying that, or accusing the EU of that?
Well, this has been certainly a trend some years ago. But as of today, there is not this attitude towards Europe by any of the parties. There are criticisms, but criticisms are normal, I would say, in political arena. And I wouldn't see any interest by any of the parties to pull out of Europe or to say that everything which is wrong is coming from Europe. No. There will be criticisms, but this is normal because a number of things in Europe are not going in action. And it is something which is felt not only in Italy, but all over the continent. I mean, the European Union is having a lot of trouble to maintain its policy going.
Well, the European Union is grappling with a lot of different issues. Of course, the Ukraine conflict is right center of this. And Mahmoud Rafat, if you want to take a look at other countries, as our guest there said, within the European Union, they're not doing as well. So what are we looking at in terms of EU's future at this point? You know, you have Germany that is headed either to a recession or that it's just economically not pulling its strings as it should, and that's supposed to be the powerhouse. Other economies not doing as well either. Are we looking at an EU that's going to maybe go down that road of an economic crisis that it did years ago?
Well, let's say it will be economic problems. We do not expect to have real crisis yet because there will be alternative for the gas of Russia. Either there will be conciliation somehow with Russia because we know the European situation against Russia and Russian-Ukrainian war is completely influenced by the administration of President Biden in the United States. We saw President Macron at the beginning wanted to take another direction, but there was lots and huge pressures on the French president to follow the same line and to be in one policy or on one frame with others. So in my opinion, there will be somehow either conciliation with Russia at the end of the day, or there will be alternative for the gas, especially from Algeria and Qatar. There will be somehow, or they will accelerate the deal with Iran, the nuclear deal with Iran, to take gas from Iran. There will be solution. So now we do not expect but a crisis, but the problem will be deep problem still. And that impacts a lot, not only the Italian situation. I expect also there will be in other European countries, South European, I mean, especially in Greece and Spain, there will be some troubles by next winter at the same time. That's not only the German and French economy will go down. This is not the unique reason, but also because of the political equations inside these countries, the south of Europe, all the south of Europe. Because of lots of reasons, their politicians, the disagreement among their politicians, the economic situation, the immigration, the load of immigration, because this is making a heavy load on these countries, there will be somehow troubles. Well, let me say I do not wish to we have here in Europe crisis, but for sure we will pass through some economic problems.
Okay. Going through some of the headlines of how Italy is being covered, it was very interesting, Paolo Raffone, to look at one of them that doesn't appear to give a fair shake or a justice, I should say, to some political parties in Europe, where the headline reads, Italy's crisis redoubles Europeans' foreboding. Europe is being tested not only in its unified front to Russia, but in the very resilience of its democracies, as nationalist forces sympathetic to Russia remain untamed. This comes from a reputable organization, New York Times. Why do you think the New York Times would describe this in this form and manner? It's quite odd, isn't it?
Well, the fact that there is a surge of nationalism all across Europe is not new. And I have to point out that the strongest nationalism is in Eastern Europe, which is strongly anti-Russian, but is definitely very nationalist. And this you have in Poland, in Lithuania, in Romania, and so on. So this is not a new issue, and Europe is confronted with rising nationalism even in Germany. In Germany, you don't have a Germany as such. You have at least three major areas in Germany, which have each of them a different view of what Europe is or should be. And especially two out of three are signaling a stronger nationalist identity, which is not compatible with this homogeneous approach that the European Commission wants to have all over the territories of Europe. So it is a problem, certainly, and maybe it is also signaling the end of a certain way of being European Union as it has been so far. We will see. The situation is fluid at the moment, but it may change rather quickly over the next months without a leadership which is capable of reunifying the souls of the different parts of Europe.
Very well. We're fresh out of time. Thank you for that, Paolo Raffone, Secretary General of the SIPPI Foundation. And thank you, Mahmoud Rafat, President of the European Institute for International Law and International Relations. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitapoy and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decree.
His decree, though...
Ya ilaha kull shay'in wa malika ya rabba.
This is Foresight, a